Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
History, they say, repeats itself, first as tragedy, second as farce. And today we're looking at the farcical angle of things, both the history of comedy and the way in which history itself has been made the subject of comedy. Hello and welcome to The Rest is History with me, Tom Holland, and my straight man, the Ernie Wise to my Eric Morecambe, Dominic Sambrook. Dominic, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Tom. I prefer to think of myself as the... Well, I mean, what are we? We're basically... Laurel and Hardy, aren't we? Somebody said that on Twitter, that we would be perfect for playing Laurel and Hardy. So I'll take that. Ernie Wise, I'm not so sure.
Silent comedy on podcasts, I don't know, maybe not so good. And you know, what Dominic, we really need is the help of a man who has made a living out of making people laugh, yeah. Often with a keen eye on history his material. Can
I'm
you
here.
Think of anyone?
I'm here. Yeah, I mean...
apart from yourself, it's the obvious man, Al Murray... known also as his alter ego, the pub landlord, and increasingly these days as one half of the podcasting double act fronting We Have Ways of Making You Talk About the Second World War with some other bloke whose name slips me. Al, welcome to a podcast. Must be an unusual experience for you being on a podcast.
Well, it's very peculiar being, I mean, as it were, on the receiving end, being the butt of the joke on this occasion, I suppose. Thanks for having me. I've heard several of your the one about the outbreak of the origins of the First World War, though. God, I had things to yell at my iPhone listening to
no,
that.
No, 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 no. That was all good stuff.
Oh yeah,
that was
absolutely.
All very good stuff.
Oh, I mean, as Marxist interpretations go, Dominic, honestly.
Oh, very good. Very good. So where should we start, Tom? I'll tell you what, let's start with the first funny book I ever read about history, Al, was 1066 and all that. And that's actually, for a lot of people, that's the sort of the text of sort of funny history or history as funny. Is it still funny, do you think?
Yes, I think it probably is. I mean, after that, I'm exactly the same. That was the first funny history book that was sort of given to me. I had R.J. Unstead's Looking at History, which was a sort of picture book with, you know, with Motte and Bailey castles in it and Roman underfloor heating and all the sort of kind of the imaginative framework that that I still have about the Middle Ages and before. Although we don't call it that anymore, do we? Anyway, and I had that, and I had 1066 and all that. And an awful lot of the stuff I read in 1066 and all that, I probably encountered before I then studied it properly. So my understanding of the Civil War pretty much comes from Sellers and Yeatman rather than you know, brilliant people like Blair Worden. I mean, I very much... or Christopher Hill or whoever. I very much am the Roundheads were terrible people with the right idea and the Cavaliers were nice people with the wrong idea, you know. And that good king, bad king, good thing, bad thing breakdown of history was then how I was taught it, which is, after all, why the book's so bloody funny. Yeah. It's there was a fag paper between it and O-level history, the way it was taught. And I remember when I got to do my degree being set a... tutorial question 1 week of, was King John a bad king? And you think,
yeah,
what the hell is going on?
Yeah. Well, of course
he was, but Richard the Lionheart was a worse king. But you know, the reason that book's funny, I mean, it's Homer Simpson. It's funny because it's true. You know, that book absolutely strikes hard at the way history certainly was taught. And I don't think it's taught like that anymore. You know, there's primary sources now and all that sort of stuff that my daughters have bothered themselves with. But we, growing up with that book and that parodied outlook, and seeing that, you know, that After all, for historians, history is a playpen that they lob toys at each other in. Why can't it be for everyone else? And least of all, humorists.
Yeah, I remember the wave of Egg Kings. That's how the Dark Ages were summed up.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
exactly. No matter how I try and purge that from my mind, I do find it very difficult not to think.
It's like William of Orange,
Anglo-Saxon history.
William of Orange is drawn as, yes, an orange, as an orange, isn't he? And I can never get that out of my head when thinking about William of Orange.
Yeah, some of it's very, very direct. but why
but
not?
Also, I mean, the whole good thing and bad thing. I mean, basically, that's what the British Empire seems to be at the moment. It's people on Twitter debating, was the British Empire a good thing or a bad thing? And it doesn't really seem to have changed. Although you mentioned the First World War right at the beginning, listening to Dominic with his nonsense Marxist spiel.
Yeah.
And
crazy.
Am I right? It's quite a while since I read 1066 and all that, but doesn't it finish just before the First World War? Because America becomes top nation and then history comes to a full stop.
Yes, it does. I mean, so it's Fukuyama, I mean, but for the 1910s, isn't it? History has ended. But I think there is a sequel. I don't remember because the...
Yeah, isn't there, Al? And who wrote that?
There's a new sequel.
Promote yourself.
All right. I mean, shameless book plugging on this podcast would really be out of line.
it's unheard of.
I wrote a book last year during lockdown, which in itself was an extremely... I found very, very challenging as a comic writer, because after all, when you write the difference between writing a stand-up show and writing a book is with a stand-up show, I'll sit here in my office and write some, or in a car, usually on my way somewhere, and then I'll go on stage and I'll try it. When you write a live stand-up show, you co-write it with the audience anyway. They're the co-writer. They're the Crofty or Perry or whatever. They're the other person going, no, that doesn't work. Yes, that works. Extend that idea and build on it. Which you can't do that with a book. And also the other thing with the stand-up show is you sign off on it. You never sign off on it. So if I take a touring show out, I'll do 200 nights, and it's always different every night because you're always permanently tweaking and always fixing and always able to streamline it. Whereas when you write a book, you hand it over and that's it, and you can't do anything about it apart from the, you know, grammar being wrong, or is that joke the right way round, that you get back sometimes from an editor. So I what's it called? The Last 100 Years, Give and Take, and all that, which I was commissioned to write, and my vanity demanded that I write in all that book. I don't know how good an idea it was, but getting to grips with the 20th century and trying to make it funny felt like felt like entirely possible, actually.
Because I guess the reason that 1066 and all that finishes with the First World War is that
you couldn't have made that
too close.
Because
when's it? It was written in 1930s, I think. So it would have been too close in a way.
Yeah. I do wind the book down in sort of 1999 because when I went to university to study history in 1987, the curriculum began in 1964. Or ended, depending on, you know, history began or ended, depending on your point of view. You know, further back is history. So the watershed moment was 1964, which at the time when I was 19 felt like an eternity, the 23 years or whatever it was. But now, actually, 23 years ago is only the late 90s when my eldest daughter was born. It feels like the paint hasn't dried on it yet. So I did shy away quite considerably from writing about the last 20 years because it's all too close.
Yeah.
And also, you know, as a responsible historian, it's impossible to draw conclusions about the events of the 2010s yet, isn't it, gentlemen?
We need
to leave that to our antecedents, you know, in the next century. It's their job to be dispassionate.
Well, we've had exactly this conversation on this podcast about when history, when you start writing history. And my take on it was it's about 20, 30 years before you get some sense of the dust settling. And
yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you can't. Trump, for instance, he might be the easy bit. You know, he might be John the Baptist.
Yes, exactly.
In the historical process. And so to sort of try and contain him in a way historically, I think would be folly, you know.
But with Sellers and Yateman not writing about the First World War, I'm guessing it's not just because it's so close, but because it was so traumatic.
Yeah, I imagine.
And so, Al, I mean, you know, your podcast, we have ways of making you talk.
Yes.
There's a hint, you know, it's a joke. It's a pun. Yep. And the theme of comedy and the Second World War, I mean, actually, when you look at it, a surprising amount has been done. So there's Spike Milligan, who fought in it, wrote a series of kind of brilliant books about it.
Yep.
Then you have Dad's Army, and then Allo Allo, and there is a quite, you know, considering the trauma, the suffering, the violence, the horrors of the Second World War, there is quite a surprising amount of comedy about it, isn't there?
Well, I think there's a surprisingly small amount about it. The other way around. As the you know, it's the, as the sort of historical elephant in the room, the Second World War is the all roads lead to it forwards and back, I think. And I mean, it's interesting. I mean, Allo Allo is a case in point, because that, after all, is about a piece of television. It's a parody of Secret Army rather than of the Second World War. And then which after all, was trading on its own 70s Second World War tropes and ideas. And then Allo Allo is lampooning that and then digging into them even further, which I think's quite, you know, is that postmodern? I don't know if we would have been allowed to call it that in the 80s when it was on. But I mean, you know, Milligan's war memoirs are written when he starts getting old, and he starts reminiscing and he starts trying to digest and deal with his experiences. Because after all, they end with his war culminates, as it were. His war experience culminates with he has a nervous breakdown, battle fatigue, is taken out of the line. And then the last three books of his memoirs are him piecing himself together to go home. And so... Clearly, he was trying to deal with that. But the Goon Show, which is the thing where he bust open and he's the most important comic voice in British comedy post-war. I think without any doubt, he breaks everything wide open. He changes everything. He's using stuff from America that other people haven't quite got their heads round yet, like the Marx Brothers. And he comes to the 50s, and the Goon Show is this extraordinary surrealist satire about the war, about class, about posh chaps skimming off honest folk. The fact that Grippipe Thin, who's this incredible smoothie who talks like that, played by Sellers, is always trying to do over essentially the blue collar characters in it, or Colonel Bloodknock, who's an incompetent a posh military officer. It's about the war. The Goon Show is about the war. But he's hiding in plain sight because he's presenting it as a sort of surrealist, bonkers set of adventures. And I think that's the interesting thing about Milligan is that way before he writes a book about the war, way before he tackles it, he's dealing with it. He's
processing. Couldn't you say that a lot of the stuff, though, is more deeply rooted? So it goes back to things like the Wipers times and the humour in the trenches in the First World War, where people also made jokes about the generals and the officers. And
yeah, I mean, I don't know what Milligan knew about that. But yes, absolutely. I mean, any war is going to generate humour. And then we get into arguments about how appropriate any laughing about anything in particular is, and which are questions of taste after all, rather than anything else. But the Wipers time is a fantastic example, and also of, you know, technology being available to people to express their humour. And that's why we know about the Wipers times, because they wrote it down. And so often humour is a liminal thing that exists in the ether and disappears and is momentary, and so it's very hard to pin down actually what's making people laugh when.
But Al, let's dig into that question for a second about taste and what's appropriate. Yes. So, because I mean, these are questions that...
We'll get cancelled, we need to be careful.
But these are questions not just for comics. They're questions for historians or writers or anybody engaging with the human experience in any way. So let's take the super controversial subject of the moment, slavery. Could you imagine doing something funny or a comedy set? I mean, it seems so horrific that you kind of recoil instinctively from the idea, but could it be done?
Well,
it has been done.
Tom.
Well, it's been done in Up Pompeii, which I know is set up 2,000 years ago, but Frankie Howard is a slave, and the thing about that is that it's very culturally literate, because that's the form that Roman comedies took. There were kind of, you know, the sassy slave who provides the commentary on the masters. And when did that run? 70s, I think?
70s, yeah.
And it was regarded, I guess, as completely unproblematic.
But that's because it's a different kind of slavery.
Would it be now? Yeah, but would people are much more sensitive now about slavery, I think, than they were. And I wonder whether having your kind of lead comic actor as a slave, would that be as unproblematic as it was in the 70s? Yeah. I don't know. I mean, Al, you'd probably have a better sense of that than...
Well, I mean, I wouldn't take it to BBC One right now.
No. No.
Maybe Channel 5. The thing is, I think what's very interesting is these are questions of taste, after all, and tastes change. There's this forever argument. I mean, it's interesting that you're framing like this because 10 years ago, there was an argument that comedy's about pushing boundaries. You know, you've got to be edgy. You've got to break boundaries. And, you know, and those arguments were wheeled out in defense of people during the Russell Brand, Jonathan Ross, Saxgate debacle. That argument was wheeled out by quite serious people. Comedy's job is to push the boundaries. But, well... every now and again, somebody go, not those boundaries.
Yeah.
yeah, but not those boundaries. Thank you very much. We'd rather not. And, you know, Milligan, of course, Milligan spent 10 years inserting rude names into the Goon Show and having them removed if the censor at the BBC spotted them. And, you know, characters called Hampton Wick. It's a bloke with a big dick. You know, he spent a great deal of time doing that because those were the boundaries and those were the boundaries he was kicking up against at the time, you know, and I think so much of this, there's a tangle between what are basically they're questions of taste, and but they get elevated to questions of principle, and very often that could be quite a tricky set of waters to navigate. Though what I will say is, as a practicing comedian, these things aren't half as don't strike me as half as urgent or worrying as they do if I read an article about them, you know, there's people just getting on with it, and then there's the stuff being written about it, which, after all, is the liminal world I'm talking
about. Here's a question for you, Al, about you talk about taste changing and the boundaries changing. Now, that would seem to imply that what we think is funny changes, does it?
Well, of course it does. For instance, there's a fool called Roland Le Petur, who was on the payroll of Henry II, right? And he received 30 acres from the king near Ipswich in Suffolk for his farting act.
That's funny.
He would leap, whistle and fart. He was to make an... And instead of being given his spurs, he was enrolled into the king's sergeantry service. And instead of being given a pound of pepper or a pair of spurs, his duty was to do... every day, every Christmas day at court, a leap, a whistle and a fart act.
Only at Christmas Day? What did he do the rest of the
Sultan,
year?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Well, he had his
eight beans.
Got his bowels ready.
Sultum, siffultum et petum. And so tastes change.
No, but they haven't, though, because that's something that a lot of people would find...
Well,
I mean,
maybe that's the universal thing. But, you know, I mean, you only have to look at a Shakespeare comedy to wonder... Yeah. What on earth's funny about this? Or a lot of Greek comedies, you know, which after all are comedy in the literal sense, where there's a mistaken identity and with hilarious consequences. I think, of course, tastes change. It'd be silly to expect them not to.
But Al, on the jester,
yes,
and indeed the privates in at Ypres.
Yeah,
joking about their officers and the slave in Roman comedy.
Yeah, well, these are status
in all of
positions
them.
Of these are questions of status. Yeah, absolutely.
So there's real edge there, isn't there? Because actually, the edge comes if you're in real trouble. So a slave laughing at the master, you know, even a private soldier laughing at the officer. There's real jeopardy there in a way that there wouldn't be today with an edgy.
Well, what it is or not. Or what it is it's a priced-in way of accommodating your systems of authority and how they work. And when you look at the Shakespearean idea of the jester that we have, that there's someone who can speak truth to the king because they're granted license somehow. And that it's interesting because in Roman tradition, because Roman Republican tradition, they're much more interested in freaks and things rather than a king who has a jester, a king who has a fool. And what's really interesting is the way the jester and the fool thing develops is it's the only patron that the fool has is the king. So he's removed, divorced from other forms of patronage. So he can speak the truth. So, you know, if you're Henry VIII's fool, the Duke of Norfolk can't get at you by bribing you. You speak truth to the king. And what is truth in this instance? Well, there's two types of fool that we see in England, and it's kind of universal in societies with kings. Two types of fool. And it's a lot to do with Christian theology. And you're going to... So, you know,
don't encourage him, Al.
Tom emerges from his torpor.
Great.
Tom was asleep to you.
And it's basically, and a lot of it, what it comes down to is the idea of innocence and theological innocence. And if you are someone who has what we would probably call a learning disability now, if you're someone who can't get to the grips with the world as it's seen, so theology in the early Middle Ages and through to the Tudors, you're regarded as innocent before God because you don't know what's going on. And this turns into the idea of there's two types of fool. There's naturals, who are people who have some sort of mental disability. And then there's artificials, who are people who pretend to have some sort of disability. And it's the ones who get their heads chopped off are the artificials, because in the end, they have no defence before God or their king or their patron. Because if they speak out of line, everyone goes, well, we know perfectly well you're not innocent. You're putting it on. This is your act. And they're the guys who get into trouble. Whereas the innocents tend not to. You know, you look at Will Sommer, who was Henry VIII's fool. He's then in the court of Edward VI. He goes through to Queen Mary's court as well, and I think lives until Elizabeth. Now, if we look at the 1066 and all that version of the Tudor politics at that time, you know, if you're in with Henry VIII, you can't be in with you know, if you're in with Edward, you can't be in with Mary. You can't possibly be in, you know, a manageable presence within the court of Tudor England like that. But he runs right through because he's innocent, and because he performs a function, and. You see that there's also a blurred line where basically you have people who are companions to royalty, who quite clearly have some sort of mental disability because they're not troubled by the burdens of power and the court and all that sort of stuff, and you can just have them as your pal, and fools occupy this really interesting, strange liminal space. And all the way through English court records, you see them on the payroll. They eat on their own. They don't eat with the jesters. They're separate from the minstrels, rather. And minstrels start out as servants and then realise that if you're a servant who can play the lute, you're worth twice a servant who can't. And so you end up with this sort of weird hodgepodge of court followers. And at the heart of it is the fool. And there's the moment in the 16th century where they sort of break out when the theatre comes along. And there's essentially a technological moment where theatre establishes itself as a piece of sort of technology. And fools start doing both. And there's Richard Tarleton, who is not only a court fool, but also a professional fool and one of the Queen's men. And he's basically the beginning of the end of the idea of the Lear-like fool and the transition into comedian, full-on comedian. And he tours the country. He has an international reputation as a touring comic, and is also one of the, you know, the 12 Queen's Men. And comedians relied on royal patronage, and then it flips into they have a public constituency and people to play to, and all the while there is this idea that they're telling the truth. And they're allowed to tell the truth because they don't understand the real world and theology. They're not going to go to hell for what they say, as it were.
Well, Al, I think that's a brilliant note on which to take
to hell.
The liminality, the hell.
But before you do, there's a great story. And this goes all the way back to the second emperor Qin in 209 to 207 BC. He announces that he's going to lacquer the Great Wall of China, right? And the courtiers all basically, the story is the courtiers all look at each other and go, oh, you're going to tell him? No, I'm not going to tell him. What a terrible idea. And there's a fool called Twisty Pole who steps forward and says, that's a brilliant idea, boss. But the problem is how are we going to get it to dry? We're going to have to build a great big drying house over it. And the emperor goes, oh, yeah, obviously. What a terrible idea. And so the courtiers don't have to confront him. And that's what the fool is for.
And do you think that was used, that the fool was always used as that sort of safety valve?
Dominic.
Yeah.
We've, yes. Dominic, we've got to have a break and we've just had
riding riff, we've got roughshod over your brain.
No, we've had a Great Wall of China joke. That is the perfect note on which to go.
Have your break.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome back to The Rest is History. We're talking comedy, comics. Before the break, I cut Dominic
off.
It
was rude.
He had some question or other. Dominic, what was your question?
So my question was about fools as safety valves. Al was talking about fools as this. So they're in a position that nobody else is in. And do the courtiers knowingly use them to deliver the undeliverable message and so on?
Well, yes, you'd have your own. I mean, one of the interesting things about Will Sommer is he's poached from some other duke. You know, the fool that precedes Will Sommer is a guy called Sexton that was Thomas Wolsey's fool. And when Wolsey falls from grace, one of the conditions that he's left to live out his remaining days in peace is that he hands over his fool. So he surrenders Sexton to the king, who's not happy about it. And then eventually, as Sexton gets old, someone says, there's this great fool in this household. The king should have him. So there's a circuit of it. Everyone's doing this. But I mean, this is a very hard, I mean, in answer to your question, that you posited just before as a safety valve. It's a hardwired idea, this. Certainly, definitely deep in Western European culture. Erasmus says they can, as he says of Renaissance fools, they can speak truth and even open insults and be heard with positive pleasure. Indeed, the words that would cost a wise man his life are surprisingly enjoyable when uttered by a clown. For truth has a genuine power to please if it manages not to give offence, but this is something the gods have granted only to fools.
Nice. So, Al, since Tom was so rude, I'm going to ask a second question.
Yeah.
And this is to follow up on that a little bit.
He's much more pushy than his brother.
Is he? He's more pushy than his brother. Interesting.
No, I'm not. Honestly, getting onto the strategic level here, I don't think so.
All right. Listen, now, something that came up in my mind while you were just talking was a few years ago, Jonathan Coe wrote an essay in the London Review of Books talking about satire. Yeah. And he was talking about Britain sinking, giggling into the sea, which is this sort of this image of us awash with satire. But basically, satire being Jonathan Coe, the novelist Jonathan Coe, thought of satire as not as a safety valve and not as a healthy thing, but as an unhealthy thing. That we were too busy being slightly complacent and laughing at ourselves. That he thought our obsession with satire had produced Boris Johnson and Brexit and bad government, and that instead of we should be as a society more angry, and things like "Have I Got News for You," he thought as positively bad for us. What's your take?
Well, I think that's interesting because I think one of the big problems with the S word has been a failure to define terms when people talk about it. You'll very often see. I mean, we talked about The Goon Show earlier. I would contend that that's a satire, that The Goon Show is satire. It's surrealist satire, but it's satire. But Milligan being a blue-collar Irishman at the time, no one saw it for what it was. And then, of course, you get the satire boom in the 60s, which is called that with a capital S. And because they're all people who should have ended up in the Foreign Office or in academia, it's seen as some sort of extraordinary break, an incredible moment that we all live in the shadow of forever since. And I don't think I think the problem with that narrative is that jokes about the news and jokes about politicians aren't necessarily satire. You know, Tom Sharp, I think wrote satire, but no one would include him in a sort of satirical lineage now. They would talk about "Have I Got News for You" as satire. And I don't think it is. I think it's a topical news program and topical news comedy program. I don't think it's satirical because does it prick at our underlying assumptions? Is it saying you get the politicians you deserve, or is it the part of the process of delivering us the politicians we deserve? Which I think is what Jonathan means. I think what he means is there's too much levity rather than too much satire. It's how I'd read that. Because one of the problems in broadcasting, of course, because I mean I've just written on the last series of Spitting Image, and the interesting thing about Spitting Image is we all have a very rosy tinted spectacle view of it when it first started, and you watch the first series and it's all over the shop because it's a brand new program in a literally a new medium of trying to do this through puppetry and impressions and all that, and they just about get away with it, and they do it on shock, you know, because it's so extraordinary to see. And maybe, I mean, after all, satire, it's juvenile, isn't it, Tom? And the thing about juvenile is it's all been censored because it's filth, isn't it?
Well, juvenile is, incredibly filthy.
What do we mean by satire, you know? Because in juvenile's juvenile case, it's lots of really filthy, filthy jokes, isn't it? And,
very, very bitter, very, very bitter commentary. I mean, Juvenal would definitely get cancelled now because, he detests immigrants. He's always going on about how awful immigrants are. And he hates women. He's misogynist. I mean, in almost every, he basically hates everyone and everything. And I think is, you know, would is kind of tough. He's tough to read. Certainly for our sensibilities now.
Yeah. I think I know what Jonathan's driving at, but I think you've got to ask yourself whether things are satire or not. I mean, I think Jonathan's books are satire in a way that "Have I Got News for You" probably isn't.
Isn't it also the fact that the giggling, sinking, giggling into the sea? Isn't that also Peter Cook? And Yeah. And the you were talking about how the Goon Show is a satire on the Second World War,
yeah.
And so famously is Beyond the Fringe with the we need an act,
a futile gesture at this point,
a futile gesture, and all that, and that presumably, Dominic, you'd know better than anyone. I mean, that was genuinely shocking when someone did when they did that. Was it?
I'm always unsure about this. I think some people were shocked, just like some people were shocked by that was the week that was. But it's a sort of a performance of being shocked, I think, often,
well,
rather than genuine.
See, I agree. I agree with that. I think that because after all, very often humor and its locus is really, really important. Jimmy Carr a while ago it's quite a while back. This he got into trouble for telling a joke. That he had heard at Headley Court, and Headley Court was the rehab place for injured British soldiers, and there were lots of guys from Afghanistan there. And a bloke there said to him, "Well, whatever else happens, we're going to get a great Paralympic team for 2012 out of this, aren't we? Ha ha ha!" Right? And that was a injured soldier's joke told in an injured soldier setting, and Jimmy lobbed it in as a shocking bar, but he got into trouble for it. But that's because he moved the locus of the joke, he tried to take a seedling and plant it in the wrong garden, if you see what I mean. And I think that we need a futile gesture from you, Perkins, is probably, if you were an airman during the war, they were probably all saying that to each other, that's the black humour that informs extremely difficult situations. Squaddy humour is extremely dark. It's the fact that they were doing it in an unexpected environment. And after all, they're nice chaps who really ought to have been in the Foreign Office and been Oxford Dons. It's as much to do with the shock of the people deciding to behave like this, deciding to joke about this, rather than the jokes themselves. And, so much framing and context colours people's reactions as much as the material. Very often the material goes by the by. I mean, Ricky Gervais says, people often hear the words in a joke, and they don't think for a moment what the joke's about. They just hear the things in it and don't think what's this actually about. And I think, there's a famous account of a guy when Beyond the Fringe transferred to New York, who stood up at the end of one sketch and said, "You're a bunch of absolute rotters," and then sat back down again and enjoyed the rest of the show. So outrageous performance is as performative as laughing sometimes. Being in on a joke or being out on a joke they're as important as each other.
Well, what's your take on?
Well, we've got
jokes.
Hold on, Tom.
I want to ask my question, Tom. Don't do this again.
No. We've I've got firm instructions that we've got to do some of the questions from the listeners. So, Dominic, you're just so domineering.
I know.
He's like this all the time.
I'm just bullying.
Tag dog with his questions.
The thing is, I mean, can't stop talking, and Tom can never get a word in edgeways. I've actually got a message from the producer
saying...
It's just
impossible.
I've actually got a message from the producer, Tom, saying, ask your question. So I'm going to ask my question. My question is this.
God's sake, and now I'm being undermined by the producer.
Yeah, this is... I've been waiting
you
for this moment.
You see what I have to put up with, Al?
Does this happen on the other podcast?
No. They gave up trying to control
just said,
us
sorry.
Long ago.
It's too late right, now. Al. Go on, Dominic. Give us your fascinating question.
So it's a good question. It's a question about comedy that was once funny and is now dated. Should it be, as it were, cancelled? I.e., should it be preceded by a warning, or should it just simply not be broadcast? And since you're a big Spike Milligan fan, Spike Milligan is a very good example of this, because, of course, did routines, or he played characters in the 1970s, Blacking Up, for example,
completely.
That now, if the BBC broadcast it, there would be howls of outrage. So how should broadcasters and people like that deal with this sort of issue?
Well, I mean, what they could do is commission some new stuff so they don't need to fill their schedules with boring old things from the old days. I mean, I think as someone actually concerned with making comedy, that strikes me as the solution to the problem. And after all, jokes about now. I mean, Barry Humphreys famously says, "The moment you die, you're no longer funny." The comedy lives right in the present moment. And of course, it's not funny if it's from 30 years ago, 40 years ago. Of course not, because aside from those racist aspects, all the frames of reference will be shot anyway. And I think it's remarkable when things are funny from the olden days.
But lots of things are funny. I mean, I watched Fawlty Towers with my son the other day, and he found that funny.
Yeah, that's pretty funny, but there's been a bit of that sliced out because people...
Yeah, you're right. You're right, the major.
Again, have done the thing where they miss the subject of the joke and they hear the words, and sometimes that's enough for people that they, no, I'm sorry, can't be around that. We can't joke about that in that way anymore.
Okay, we have a question from the brilliantly named Keir Hardley. You like that? That's very
That's
good.
That's the funniest thing on this program so far.
Entirely functional.
Love the show. Love the show.
Yeah.
And also love we have ways of making you talk despite my very limited understanding of military history. So that's for you, Al.
And he says, are
some things taboo because of our prevailing attitudes now? So that's what we've been talking about. But what I wonder is there a kind of churn that... certain things are always held to be sacred or unsayable or whatever, and that then kind of automatically generates comedy, because the moment you're not, it's kind of like getting the giggles at, you know, a funeral or something. Not being allowed to laugh about something kind of almost automatically makes you want to laugh about it.
Well,
yes, that's a kind of part of the cycle of what goes on.
Absolutely, you know, and after all saying the unsayable is an awfully good way of claiming you're saying the unsayable is an awfully good way of selling tickets or creating, making a name for yourself. Sure. Let's not forget, you know, that the comedy exists in a, like any other art form, exists in a raw world of commerce and direct. And, you know, we were talking about royal patronage earlier. You know, now the king doesn't pay for comedians. Everyone pays for their own personal jesters. We live like kings now. We each have the jesters we prefer, the fools we prefer the opinions of, who tell us the truths we want to hear. So, yeah, but there is relentless. There's endless churn. I mean, there was in my career, there was when I first started out, you had to be political, and if you weren't, there was something really quite wrong with you. And then, sort of Vic and Bob, who for my money were very much channeling a kind of Milligan-esque goonish streak, and satirical as well. But of course, because they're not posh, no one would ever call it that. They said, no, actually you can muck about if you want, and it changed, and the fashion changed, and then there was a pretty solid decade in the early part of this century where if you didn't do jokes about rape, you were some sort of coward, you know, in terms of edge and all that sort of thing. These things just change. The moment something's taboo, comics, because after all a lot of them are driven by mischief, if nothing else, are drawn to these taboo subjects magnetically. And sometimes they're not. Sometimes you just think, well, an audience won't stomach this, and after all, it's a pas de deux with an audience, the whole thing, and I'll we're all here to have a good time, aren't we? Rather than be confronted about the truth all the time, which is, after all, one of the means to the ends. And there's very often a confusion between means and ends in comedy anyway. The end is to make people laugh, and you get there any way you can. There's no right way, wrong way.
Or perhaps the end of comedy is to instill in people a general sense of a historical period. This, at any rate, is the argument of Robert Mantell, who asks, how much do you think comedy shapes popular views of history? For example, how much of our view of the First World War is Blackadder, or of Roman Judea is Python? And he says, it feels like comic takes often have a broader reach and more staying power than serious dramas.
Well, that's a very good...
I mean, that's interesting, isn't it?
That's an excellent question. And I think what's really interesting about that, I think, is that it's Blackadder 4 that's the one that I don't think anyone looks at the second series of Blackadder with Queen Elizabeth in it and thinks, oh, that's what Elizabethan England was like. I don't think there's any feeling of verisimilitude in that. And I don't think the Georgian...
I don't know,
Blackadder
though.
3,
that's the lasting image people have of the Prince Regents, isn't it?
Well, yeah, for my money, I think it's as good as any other history I've read or seen of that period. It's certainly
as
entertaining.
Quite flattering to the Prince Regent, isn't it?
It is, actually, yeah. Because Blackadder 4 occupies this... I mean, it's very interesting that you know, the First World War was kind of in living memory when they made it, but it was also firmly in living myth by then, like any proper big historical event in this country. You know, all sorts of established things that were true about it. You know, Gary Sheffield, who's the guy at Wolverhampton who wrote Forgotten Victory, who's made all sorts of sort of... you know, and he's written Haig's biography and also... And he's, you know... Loath to call him a revisionist of First World War history, but he says, you know, Blackadder, the problem is when you're trying to teach First World War history is getting past Blackadder. You know, that Stephen Fry saying we'll move, you know, the General Melchett, we'll move forward an inch tomorrow and then we'll move back an inch today or whatever it is. And that's what people really do think happened. And it can seem like a straw man that, oh, well, they saw Blackadder, so that's what people think of the First World War. But, you know, you and I both know history does not belong to the people who write history books. They have this 10% of the ownership of what history is. History so often exists in so much discourse that it's the story you tell about yourselves as a country as much as anything else. Or the kind of person you are reflects the kind of history you like, and your view of world history is what kind of person you are and your values and all that sort of stuff. And I think, and Blackadder is such a powerful program for shaping people's ideas of the First World War. And
it wouldn't have been as powerful without the end.
I was just about to say that, Tom. No. It's the last 5 minutes. Because it's a comedy program daring to do something that most sitcoms never did, which is kill off all the characters.
And I worked with the director who made that series. And he said that was one of those decisions where he said, this is what we should do. And it went right to the top of the BBC with him going, we can't do that. It's a comedy program. Don't be ridiculous. And they did it anyway. And then, of course, everyone in the brass at the BBC high-fived themselves for their brilliant creative decision. So, but yes, I mean, yeah, comedy is an excellent. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, I'd much rather watch Life of Brian than Gladiator to get a sniff of what the Roman Empire might have been like.
Well, it's interesting that the Life of Brian, which I think is actually very like Hello, Hello. It's a parody of a drama rather than of, say, you know, I mean, it's a parody of the Sword
and
Sandal
epics and Sword
and Sandal
epics,
and all that kind of stuff. But we did an episode last week on empires, and we got asked again and again, kind of variations of what have the Romans ever done for us, and on the whole debate about, you know, are empires good things or bad things. That is the line that always gets brought up, and also whenever there's any kind of political factionalism, it's always Judean People's Front. And those two lines have the kind of sticking power of, you know, any great drama. They sum up incredible historical complexities in a kind of convenient shorthand that can then be debated.
They're like a meme on Twitter, you know, that they sum the thing up, bosh, they, you know, and comedians live for a thing that lands like that. You know, if you can just get one thing through like that, I still think what I love about Life of Brian is that, you know, Python's output up to then had been them sort of, you know, breaking genres and writing sketches without punchlines and generally just showing what brilliant comic minds they were. Thank you very much. And then what they do is they then feed a subject, an actual subject, into their Mincer, and out comes Life of Brian, which is the most coherent thing with incredibly, you know, ideas hidden in plain sight and all that sort of stuff that I think's really just a fantastic
and the Holy Grail
discussion
as well.
Of religion and Holy Grail as well. Holy Grail,
you know, which is incredible in kind of the structuring of, you know, because we've done an episode on Arthur as well, and basically the whole theme of that was how it, you know, it's made up from all kinds of different bits, and the way in which Holy Grail just completely deconstructs the whole thing, and exactly that kind of, it's brilliant.
And it shows that, I mean, it demonstrates that comedy can if you get it right, of course, you know, can shed as much light as any drama ever could. You know, a serious drama about King Arthur, whatever. But a comedy film that sort of finds it, you know, the Holy Hand Grenade is an incredibly funny idea. The Holy Hand Grenade of Antioch is an incredibly funny idea.
Al, let me ask you this. Is there an extent to which, though, I mean, you obviously think a lot about the recent history of comedy and the history of comedy generally.
Yeah.
But when we tell the recent history of comedy, is there a danger that we sometimes overemphasize things that comedians find funny or things that, as it were, cultural elites find funny rather than things
you
that...
You bet.
So let me give you an example. If you were to compare the viewing figures of The Young Ones, which obviously was very influential, and Heidi High, I mean, the chalk and cheese, Heidi High was colossally more popular. And maybe arguably tells you more about what early 80s Britain found funny. Now, that may be distasteful to a lot of people because they think, well, Heidi High is rubbish and mainstream and Young Ones is much edgier
but
and more interesting.
The guy, Gladys Pugh's, the, the one she was in love with.
Yeah, Simon Cadell.
The guy who runs the...
Yeah,
he,
Simon Cadell.
He was an RAF pilot, wasn't he? So he was
he's
from the
funny.
War. I think he's So there is a threat to the war there.
Simon Cadell wasn't... No, he was a contemporary of Charles Brandreth. He was a friend of his.
No, but the character he plays...
Oh, the character. Yeah,
the character is a failed Cambridge Don or something, isn't he? He leaves academia to run a holiday camp.
Yeah. Oh, maybe that's it.
I mean, what,
yes. Okay.
What I'd say to you, Dominic, is I like them both.
Of course, but, I mean, I'm not saying you can't like them both.
But yes, well, maybe.
But the
maybe.
Story that we but tell I, tends I, to emphasise edginess and pushing
and
boundaries
novelty, yes.
and novelty.
Yes, shock of the new rather than the shock of the old, you know, which is that David Edgerton argument about technology, you know, that scooters designed in the 1930s are all over the world still, but no one's interested in them. They're nowhere near as fascinating as anything. Well, I think you know, I think if you watch the young ones now, and I haven't seen it in ages, and I remember that show being like bashed over the head with a sort of Technicolor hammer. It was the most extraordinary thing to watch when I was 15, and is entirely responsible for me being interested in comedy as much as any other thing. I think it might look as dated now as Heidi High.
It doesn't. It doesn't. I watched it last week, oddly. I watched the first series.
And Tom, you have nothing better to do than watch old series of The Young Ones.
It was so good. I suddenly discovered that I'd inadvertently been paying for BritBox.
Oh, well done.
I obviously pressed the wrong button at some point, so I thought, well, I might as well get something out of it. So I'll just... And I was thinking exactly that. Were The Young Ones as funny as I remembered it? Actually, they were funnier, and they were more scabrous, and they were more shocking, and they seemed...
So there was more going on than you might have noticed as a
kid.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, a lot more. I thought it really held up. Although I think that I loved Heidi High as well. So.
I think I expect if I watched Heidi High, there'd be more going on than I realised as a kid too. That
there was
be
a lot going on, wasn't
relationships
there?
And tensions and all that sort of stuff that you wouldn't spot. You know, I think that's a really good question. And you're absolutely right. I mean, the thing that's changed in broadcasting, of course, is that we're talking about a time where there were four channels, max. And so you either watched Heidi High or you watched whatever on ITV.
Yeah, but here's an interesting thing. Tom and I had a podcast about the 90s, and we were talking about the fragmentation of culture. So the 90s being the last point where you had a collective culture, popular culture.
Yeah.
And have we lost a collective comedic culture?
Well, that's a really interesting thing. Yeah, we definitely have. And I think... And I think that's entirely down to, you know, the change in broadcasting that's happened in the last 30 years. I mean, and also that Dennis Norden said that when he started writing comedy after the war, it was dead easy to get going and to make an audience laugh because everyone had been through the same thing. That everyone had been through the Second World War, so to some aspect they all had an opinion on it. And they all had some shared experience, but they also had the big shared experience, you know. And so you could with assurance know that if you wrote a joke about rationing, that it would land with everyone one way or another, that they'd all have some reaction to it. And I think, interestingly, maybe we're about to enter a period of that's a bit similar to that, because we have all been through the same thing. I mean, obviously, what a lot of comics will think, right, whatever I do, you know, if there's an Edinburgh Fringe this year, there'll be a whole lot of people going, I'm absolutely not going to talk about bloody lockdown. I'm not going to mention it. I'm going to write about something else, anything else, because audiences are sick of lockdown. They won't want to talk about it. But it may be that there needs to be a great, you know, safety valve letting off of steam that needs to happen comedically. I don't know. And I think, yes, we definitely are. It's much more comically diverse. Although, you know, one of the standard narratives that's doing the rounds, you can't joke about anything anymore. The stuff you can joke about now that you couldn't joke about, you know, 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 50, 60 years ago, the explosion in subject matter and a loosening of stuff. There's only one or two things you can't joke about anymore, boys and girls. You know, it's actually what it comes down to. And there's the sheer range of subject matter, approaches, angles and methods and styles. It's like it's an infinite explosion.
But isn't that sort of damaging to an extent that a society maybe needs to laugh at the same jokes, laugh at the same things? I mean, obviously, we're never going to get back to that world of the Morecambe and Wise Christmas special where 30 million people have watched the same...
But I think that's like looking at the 50s as a new golden age of the nuclear family. That's the anomaly. There was only a short period. There's only 10 years really where radio comedy was enormous before TV came along, the 50s, when everyone listened to the same radio program and then everyone watched the same TV program. And now, you know, everyone's on YouTube. I mean, so much of this is technological anyway. Back when there was music hall, not everyone was laughing at the same stuff because there was no means of transmission to create that idea of national jokes that we all understand.
And actually, Al, there are much more regional jokes. People wouldn't understand the jokes that in London, Liverpool, and Manchester, or even each other.
You know, Charlie Chaplin, when he's called as a witness in the Lake District before he goes to America, they think he's French because they can't understand what he's saying.
Al, your mention of Dennis Norden.
Yes.
Can I just give a shout out to my friend Jamie Muir, whose dad Frank Muir wrote Dennis Norden.
Gosh.
And together they wrote what must surely be the greatest line from any comedy about history, Carry On Cleo.
Infamy.
Infamy. They've all got it. Infamy.
Yeah.
So that's for you, Jamie, if you are listening to this. I think we need to pull the curtain down here. We have, I guess, entertained you all enough. Al, thanks so much. That was absolutely brilliant. We will be back next week. I can't remember what we're talking about. We're talking about Americanization, aren't we, Dorman?
We are. Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah, we are.
We're talking about how the world became American.
And is it becoming un-American?
So we will see you then. Al, thanks so much.
A total pleasure. See you all next week.
Thanks, Al.
Thanks, gents.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.